My name... Hi, Bobalicious. That's Bobalicious. That's what his wife calls him, and I've got permission. My name's Cindy Masters, and I'm an alcoholic. And because of the grace of God, some simple actions in this program and both sides of sponsorship, I've been sober every single day in a row since December the 17th, 1985, and for that I'm extraordinarily grateful. It's so funny because it's kind of like what you've heard all the other speakers, starting with Polly last night, say. It's like, you know, I get this amazing life because I burnt my life to the ground, you know, and because I take some simple actions, and because I take some direction, you know. Lucky me. So I'm supposed to talk about steps 8 and 9. And I don't think that, we find freedom in the fourth step. What we find in the fourth and fifth step is relief. And it says our fears begin to fall from us, not that they fall from us. Oh, I was really mad when I realized that. Because, you know, but it says it begins to fall from us. You know, in 6 and 7 doesn't say our defects are going to be removed. They say, God, you get to have the good and the bad. Take away anything in me that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and others. Oh, that's not much of a promise. It doesn't say, take away anything from me that makes me look bad. Take away anything from me that makes me feel bad. No, that diminishes my usefulness to you, which is way really lets us know, did we really make that decision in the third step? That we want to align our will with God's will. And then we get to this 8 and 9, which is where the freedom happens. And it's what I think most of us procrastinate about our fourth step for. I don't think it's to get stuff written down, and I don't think it's that we're afraid to tell somebody else these shameful things because we've usually been around AA long enough to have heard other people have all the same shameful things, you know. And my shameful stuff wasn't the big out loud stuff. My shameful stuff has been that little gnawing stuff that you really didn't know about. It really would, like that third column in that fourth step had so much more effect on me than the fourth column. Because everybody knew my fourth column. I knew I was at fault. Something happened, I'm wrong. You know what I mean? Because I've been told that my whole life. I've been locked up for it. I've been put away for it. You know? The other thing that you've heard this weekend is that the steps are evolutionary. And they are. It's like I evolve, and my capacity to be honest evolves. And as Deb so eloquently talked about in her third step talk today, so does my capacity for a relationship with God. But only if I stay open. Only if I continue to do all of the things I am required at this point in my recovery to do more, not less. More, not less. I do more than I have ever done. Oh, lucky me. And I'm not kidding with that. I am God's favorite. You'll soon learn why. I got here originally October 16th, 1980. October 16th is Rena's anniversary, 1975. I sponsor somebody who's been sober since 75. Don't ask me how that happened. But the grace of God, like all my sponsorship relationships, because I don't have a single one that I don't grow every bit as much and learn every bit as much as I don't know what they get from me, but I know what I get from them. And I know that as a group, all ships rise with a rising tide. And I've got this group of women, a lot of them are here this weekend that we do this Tuesday night meeting. And I have one woman in there that I'm her first sponsor. She's 39 years sober. How did she stay 39 years sober? Well, she did go to meetings. She sought God. She continued to be a seeker. Okay, she had a very substantial spiritual practice, but boy, did she miss all the miracles. And man, did she drive me crazy at first. Because we're talking about dry. You know, when you're 39 years sober and you're doing it, you're willing it, even your relationship with God. But she wanted something different, and she had the humility to say, I've never had a sponsor, and I never worked all the steps. I positioned myself, and I'm going to talk about this, because this is part of the amends that I made to people that I sponsored in early recovery. In early recovery, I became dogmatic and rigid, my way or the highway. And so part of my amends for that is to not be that. It's to be open and loving and kind. And I was safe enough that she could tell me that, and I wasn't going to judge her. I wasn't going to judge that she wasn't where somebody else was at 39 years sober. I let her be her. And right now she's one of my greatest delights, because she's sponsoring a woman in prison. She's sponsoring women. She never did that. You can't sponsor people if you don't have a sponsor. She did try to sponsor one woman. She's finally taken her through the steps after 20-some years. And so we're watching this miracle unfold. Julie, she'd worked the steps, can I say it? But she hadn't worked the steps for 20 years. And we get together and we do the hard work. My Debbie, you know, she's 45 years sober in our little group. And it's like, and Debbie was one of the people when I first got sober. When I first got sober and went to Oak Street in Cincinnati, I knew Debbie. Debbie was one of like my hero people when I got sober, you know? And it's like, and then she comes and asks me to be her sponsor because she didn't do AA for 20 years while she did religion and raised a family. And it's like, and I stayed in AA. And so our relationships are all very shoulder to shoulder. And we're all growing. And how, I can't believe I get to be me. I'm like, pinch me. I can't believe that these women even keep my company, let alone give me a name like sponsor. You know, I mean, Deb H., trust me, I call her plenty. Hey, I'm a little tore up this week. You know, it's, and I call my sponsor. I talk to my sponsor every week. Because here's what my sponsor said when I asked her to sponsor me. I said, I sponsor a lot of women, but I haven't really been actively sponsored for a while. I have a sponsor, but I haven't been using them. She said, you know what they call that? I said, no. She said, a cesspool. See, because it has one pipe coming in and none going out. Holy moly. The reason I go back through all that, I'm not going to spend time qualifying. I've been studying what these people did in 1939. And I've been reading Grapevine articles from 1939. And they said, when you speak, don't spend a bunch of time qualifying. They said, everybody here's drunk. They know what that's about. They also said, keep it short. They said, you know, alcoholics can only contain so much. Especially the new person, right? And I'm an alcoholic because when I drink, I get an obsession for more. And when I can't drink and I don't have recovery, all I do is think about how I can. I get an obsession of the mind. I get a physical craving once I drink some. Just give me some more. I can tell you a million stories, a lot of consequences. I got here the first time I came to AA with tons of consequences, like 7 felonies, being tried as an adult, as a juvenile, yada, yada, yada. Okay? Consequences don't make us alcoholic. What I just said make us alcoholic. And part of the reason that I relapsed is that I understood powerlessness and unmanageability, but I didn't understand concession to my innermost self. I had lingering notions that somehow, some way, if my life became manageable, I could drink successfully. And I got things, and I got success, and I tried it out, and I was a garden variety, disgusting, pitiful, incomprehensible, demoralized alcoholic. And that's where I landed. And that's what brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the short version. My first program, and it took me 5 years to get in stay sober. See, I had to drink once I got here. It talks about us in the foreword to the second edition. Those of us that come and really try, and it takes several tries. I'm one of those people. I did a 4-step to the best of my ability, to the best of the capacity I had, to be honest at the time. My sponsor shared it with my parents, confronting them. My trust went down a little bit. And uh, October 16th is also my sister's birthday. Now, that was my first sobriety date. It was my sister's 15th birthday. She just got pregnant. She was pregnant on purpose to get out of our house, which was not a safe place. And what she heard on her birthday, nobody knew she was pregnant yet. And what she heard was me screaming out of my mind in a blackout from the jail when the jail called the house. I didn't know this. I just know I wasn't allowed around that little boy when he was born. And my sister didn't want anything to do with me. And so I went and I made amends to her. And we went to her backyard and I said, I know that I hurt you. And I don't know all the ways that I hurt you. But I want to know and I want to make it right. And I want you to know I'm really sorry I couldn't be the sister that you deserve to have. And here's what happened. She broke down crying. And she said, I was her protector. She sends me Mother's Day cards now. I'm Mama's sister for my siblings. I was the oldest, and if you grow up in the kind of house I did, there's a certain bond that happens over trauma that just is a different kind of bond. And she was used to me taking all the heat, so she didn't have to take any. And I had left a few years before. I've been in 25 institutions by the time I was 17 years old. State mental hospitals, back in orphanages. I was adopted in the first place, that sort of thing. And she said she used to sit there and watch my dad beat me half to death and my mouth would keep running. And she would sit there and beg me to shut up. She would just pray that I would shut up before he killed me. And I was able to tell her, well, I couldn't shut up because he'd come after you next. And that's why I didn't. But that, her trauma from watching me get beat was worse than my trauma for being beat. And it was my first time I ever saw another person more than me. See, I could always hold mine up as being worse because my head got split, my back got broke, all these things happened. That didn't happen to her. But when I saw what that did to her watching that happen, my empathy for her, and I was going to be the best big sister somebody could be, period. That was my commitment. Now, I didn't stay sober. She was the first person that ever validated what happened to me. When Children's Services came in my house, they lied. When we went to any place that the authorities were around, everybody lied. I really didn't know if I was crazy or they were. And so my sister, and by making amends to her, and I don't say this is going to happen for everybody, but it's my experience. It began my healing journey of that wound beginning to heal. We have had, it's been a long time. It's been 45 years. We were talking about it this week. She brought it up. And she's close to being, I can't say I have a best friend, but she's in my top three. We're very different. She's evangelical. She's very religious. You know, I'm very open. But here's what you taught me to do. You taught me to see where are we aligned? What do we have in common? We talk about God. We both believe in God. You know, we both believe in God very much. You know, she called me when I'm in an airport on my way here, and she's like, oh, I wanted to come spend a weekend with you. I'm like, I'm not in town. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm so proud of her. I'm so proud of her. So that was my best attempt to kind of getting through the steps. I couldn't see everything. I could see some things. I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready to let go of what everybody had done to me. I kept this anger and this bravado and this shield about me because I didn't know. I just couldn't. I just couldn't. But I really tried, and I believe God extended me a lot of grace because I really tried. So this is not my whole story. This is about amends. I will tell you that I got sober and have stayed sober since my last drink was December 16th. My sobriety date is December 17th, 1985, which is a long time. It's a lot of life. So I thought I'd just tell you about only the first time I made amends from the first four step and tell you exactly the steps you go to do that. No, I'm not going to do that. I will tell you that one of the things that I have somebody do the first time we go through is take out a note card. And I want you to write specifically what's the harm. What's the harm you did? Do you know what you're making right? Because an amend is not to apologize. An amend is to make right. Right? That's what I've been doing with my sister all these years. There's more to talk about this amends process. I have always put her first. She was going through a divorce. She was nuts. Wasn't her fault. Her husband had a 10-year affair. Made the kids lie. Just broke her heart. You know, she had gotten an engineering degree, supported them, was everything. And she just couldn't believe that she had this childhood and then she had this kind of betrayal. The same kind of things that we have, right? But she didn't drink at it. She just got sad and crazy. And so she would come to my house and I would make her a bubble bath. And I would make her cheese trays and things. She'd only had boys. She had two boys and a husband. She had not. My mother doesn't nurture. She doesn't know how. And so I became her nurturer. And you know, for those of you who know me, I mean, I'm a Harley riding like street girl, and you know, but that's not usually what people would associate me with. But with my sister, I rose all the way up. And it's like, you know, I just love to be caring for her. And when she hurt, I'm her safe spot. How cool is that? Who gets to be that? When you wouldn't let me in the same room with your kid, I got to be that. Not all amends work out that good. I'm going to share some that haven't, because I don't want to make you think that just because I have the intention of making an amend that everybody's going to accept it and we're going to go walking through the rainforest, right? Arm in arm. But here's what happens. Every time I make my side of the street right, guess who gets better? So we write out the harm. I also have them write out their address and their phone number. Why do you think I do that? Here's their name, their address, their phone number. Here's the harm. So they don't have an excuse to not reach them. Right? So your first task before we go about making them, right? This is why it's so important to do a fear inventory like it's in the big book and to do a sex inventory like it is in the big book, right, is because not everybody's on my resentment list. Some people are on my fear list. You know, I'm afraid to see them. It creates something uncomfortable in me. You know, it's not because I'm mad at them. It's because I have done something. I'm uncomfortable. There's something I need to make right. Matter of fact, today, if you are coming at me sideways, I might have done something to create that. And the first thing I'm going to ask you is, have I done something to harm you that I'm unaware of? If I have, I'd like to make it right. Because that's my truth, right? I do want to make it right, and I don't always know. And it's like, is that my responsibility when I don't know? For me, it is. Because I want to look the world in the eye. I want to go to the mall happy. I want to go everywhere in life happy. I don't want to be afraid to run into anybody. My next really big amends story took me till I was 17 years sober to do. Now, I made a half-assed amend in early recovery. I went to my dad and said, I'm sorry I wasn't the daughter you wanted me to be. Does that sound like an amends? No, it's not. It would have been if I was willing to become the daughter he wanted me to be. But I wasn't. That was just checking the box so that I could say I did it. And here's the thing. At that time, it was the best I could do. And God gives me all the grace in the world to be sober as long as I do the best I can do. Where I don't get grace is when I'm just defiant and I won't do something, you know, just absolutely won't. 17 years sober, I'd had this highway motorcycle accident. I got drove over by a car in the middle of the highway. It's a whole other story. And then I got cancer, and then I started to walk, and I would fall down. I couldn't get up. And what had happened is my back had been broke as a kid, and when I had that wreck, it pushed my spine forward, stretched my spinal cord, and I had a spinal cord injury. And so they had to do a big deal surgery and cut part of my spinal canal and put all this hardware in to stabilize it because it was pulling on my spinal cord. And Deb kind of talked about the merry-go-round, but I always talk about the slideshow. And I, when I get a trauma similar to an old trauma that I've had, it's like I get this slideshow, click, 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 of everything that ever happened to my back, right? And it's almost like re-traumatizing. This is what heals this, okay? My sponsor says, good, Cindy, now it's time to do some forgiveness work. And by the way, I cannot make an amend where I haven't forgiven the person for their part before I go to them. So that's where it says become entirely ready. There's no shame in that it took me 17 years to do this. Because I made amends to him, but if I had done this one day earlier, I would have crippled him to his knees. Because I had not been graced with enough forgiveness to go in and do what happened. So here's what happens. I do the forgiveness work. And part of that was I had become whole enough. I don't need anything from him anymore. I can't forgive you when I still need you to repair something in me, or I still blame you for a part of my woundedness. So as a grown woman, I am responsible for every wound that exists inside of me. Me and God, I got all the goods. God will heal that. He's got the perfect medicine. But it's a process. It's not overnight. It took me all of these 17 years to get healed enough and whole enough that I could forgive him. And one of the ways we forgive him, and Polly usually talks about this, is like, I have to look at what was his childhood like. Right? His childhood was brutal. My dad loved me with all his being. I believe that he has dissociative disorder because he was the greatest and the worst. He is not an alcoholic, but he flipped like an alcoholic, but without booze, so no smell test, right? No smell test. So anyway, I went to my dad. And I didn't have much, very distant relationship. And I said, and what did I need to make amends to him for? Not a thing he did to me. And I often say this, the amends where I'm 90% wrong are easy. Because all I'm doing is saying, I screwed you over. Will you forgive me? You know, I'd like to make it right. Here's the problem. When they broke your back, and you can see all these big things and say it's 90% you, it's 10% me. Well, I don't get well if I don't take care of my 10%. See, that 10% lingers, and it'll take me down. So what I needed to make amends to him for is that anytime somebody would say something nice about him, I'd make sure they knew he wasn't nice. I would do character assassination with him. You know, I tried to harm him any way that I could besides something, you know, like that somebody could point out and say, well, you know, it's like, and so I said, you know, I don't know all the ways I harmed you, Dad. But I'm really sorry, and I know that I hurt you. I know I hurt you. And it hurt him every time that he thought I was going to die, you know, as a kid on the streets. He didn't see the connection with some of the ways that he helped put that ball in motion. That's okay. That's okay. But it hurt him. And I said, if there's anything else I've done to harm you, Tell me now, I want to listen, and I'll do whatever I can to make it right. Well, he responded with my words. He said, my cousin had confronted him. He beat me on a camping trip with an extension cord. And my back and legs had bled, and it had traumatized my cousin. And so my parents always pretend all the family like we come from Leave It to Beaver, right? Well, my cousin wasn't afraid like we were. Like, we would never say anything or confront anybody because we still had that old stuff. Well, my cousin apparently had gone and confronted my dad and said, well, what about that camping trip? And my dad said, Cindy, I don't remember that at all. And I believed him. He said, but Kevin told me that this happened on this camping trip, and I want you to know, I am so ashamed, and I am so sorry. Now, my dad had never admitted anything he'd ever done. I'd always wanted somebody to validate it. And the next thing came out of his mouth, and he said, and if there's anything else that I'm not remembering, lock and load, baby. I can hear it now. But here's the magic of God and Alcoholics Anonymous. What came out of my mouth was, that was a long time ago, Daddy. I've forgiven you. How about we go on and have the best relationship we can? That's miraculous. Oh, it gets more miraculous. Because my amend doesn't stop with that conversation. My amend is forever. My amend is at healing that relationship. I'm going to talk a lot about family stuff, right? So, my mom, I hated her. For those of you that have heard me talk a lot, you know. I hated her because she didn't stand up for us. Because she looked like the well person in the house. And she lied when children's services came. And sometimes she would say things so that I'd take a beating so he wouldn't be mad at her. And, I hated her. My brother was murdered in 2010. You know, none of us, my parents are very educated, and none of us stayed at home past 15. None of us graduated high school. You just don't do that when you come from where I come from because you're surviving, right? Now, my sister's an engineer. I'm really proud of her. She got a GED because they kicked her out of National Honor Society because she got pregnant at 15, but she went on and got a GED and went to college. I'm probably going to tell you how proud I am of her a million times. Because you gave me the ability to think about somebody besides me. You gave me the ability to celebrate other women and lift them up and lift their achievements up and not just focus on mine. And that's what I do. We practice these principles in all our affairs, not just with each other. So when my brother was murdered for the first time, I saw my mother. Now, this is 2010, so you guys can do the math. It's 15 years ago. What was I, 24 years sober? So it just shows you that I wasn't as well as somebody might want to be. And I saw how broken my mom was with my brother's murder. And I saw her guilt and her shame. And I saw the lights go out. And I hated that for her. Now, fast forward 3 months. My sister's remarried this time. She had a really great husband, and he's running an airfield in Korea, and they're back for my nephew's wedding, and he gets diagnosed with multiple myeloma, so they're at Walter Reed Hospital. I'm at the hospital in Louisville. I have a colon surgery, and they had to remove 18 inches of my intestines, and I get septic. And so, because I've had a lot of health issues, and health issues beget health issues. And so my mom's there, and she's like, you can't die. I can't handle it. It's usually about my mom. And that might have been why I lived. But I saw all of her pain, and all that I wanted, this lady that I wanted to understand how much she had hurt me. I wanted them to understand what it did for them to take me back to an orphanage because they didn't want to tell the truth. To come pick me up from the state mental hospital for Christmas. You know, I wanted her to know. And I didn't want her to know anymore. See, I had gotten whole enough that I could see her. And here's the truth. My mom was probably the biggest victim in the household. See, I didn't understand that. You know, she never had a job, right? She was an artist. She's a painter, and she's pretty good at it. But she never had to take care of herself. She tried to kill herself when I was 9 years old. I was the only kid that was awake when they wrestled the gun away from each other. You know, it's that's a wounded person, not somebody trying to leave their kids, which is what I thought at 9 years old. She's just trying to leave me, you know. And I don't know how my mom got to that, but I know that she didn't feel like she had any choices. That's the only reason that a mother ever acts in that way. And when I saw when my brother got murdered, how hurt she was and how sad she was. And by the way, my dad, he's not gotten well. Okay, I've gotten better. So he tells my mother she has 2 weeks to grieve her son from being murdered. And that is it. She is not allowed to cry in that house anymore. Now that sounds terrible, right? What a creep, right? But now let's look a year later. See, my dad is so disconnected from his feelings. He can't feel hurt. He can't handle it. A year later, my dad's sitting in his living room. I'm the one, that, by the way, that had to go tell him that my brother was murdered. But he's sitting in his tears are coming down his face, and he said, I don't have any sons. My brother's been murdered. My other brother's homeless. You know, he's like, I don't have any sons. I'm like, but you got us, Daddy. And him hurting my mom hurt me. You know, he talked terrible about my brother because he couldn't handle hurting. And that's the way that he overrode it. I had to get well enough and keep doing this work so I could see that picture through God's eyes and not through the eyes of a little girl that had been hurt by all those same things. Because I've always been seeing the world through this little hurt girl's filters. And by making amends and doing this work. So my mom, I made my mind up. I was just like I did with my sister years before. I want her to have the happiest rest of her life possible. I'm going to show up. I'm going to be there. I'm going to love her. She turned 70 while I was in the hospital. The next year, my sister and I took her and my aunt to Africa for my mom's dream trip. We went on safari, and my mom smiled again. My sister and I, while my dad wouldn't let her grieve, we would take her out, and we would let her grieve and process with us. Because that's what we could do. I couldn't change her world, but I could change the way I interacted with it. That's an amend that's not possible. Now, understand, I'm 24 years sober. Do you think I could have done that at 4 years sober? At 14 years sober? At 23 years sober? I'd say no. Because God waited till I was 24. You know what I mean? And so this is not, if you are newer, this is not like beat yourself up or why aren't I already there? If you stay the course, you take the next right step. You don't override that connection that you have with the Creator that you can feel right here. Just act on that. And we heal. And we don't walk around like the walking wounded anymore. But some of us come here and we get healed faster than others. It took me a long time. I had a lot of trauma, a lot of things, and it took time. But guess what? I'm pretty whole today. Fast forward 10 years with my mom. and I'll probably get out of family of origin stuff, maybe. We'll see where God takes this. My mom's turning 80. It's COVID. For 10 years, I've been trying to give my mom a happy life. My mom, here's what changed in that 10 years. My mom could hardly wait to get off the phone with me. The only nice thing she could say was that I was the only person in the family that had ever apologized to her, because we would all take it out on my mom, that she would take it. And we'd call her and bitch about my dad. And anytime I caught myself doing that, this was the beginning, like way before I made amends to her. The beginning was anytime I did anything like that or was anything short of respectful and courteous to my mom, I would call her back and say, "Mom, I'm so sorry. You deserve to be treated better than that." She told me how happy that made. I mean, you wouldn't, like, little crumbs she would accept as something so big. That's very telling. That's very telling. Well, there were no more crumbs, because I was giving her the whole thing for this 10 years between my brother's murder and 70 and 80. And it's like, I mean, she loved to go out to eat. She loved to travel. You know, we went to Jamaica. We went everywhere. We you know, it's like, and my mom is very self-centered. So I'm not, you know what I mean? Like, not always where I was looking forward, but always grateful I did. I had a good friend in Cincinnati that said she never regretted showing up for family, and her family was very similar to mine. And I took that in, and I believed her. At 80, my mom's mad. First of all, her birthday is December 29th. She's been mad about that her whole life, right? You know, she's competing with Christmas. And she wants people to care about her birthday. And we heard about it every year. So I'm like, "Mom, what do you want to do for your birthday?" She says, "It's COVID. I'm not going to turn 80. She's really bitter and mad about it. So I got a bunch of her friends all over the world who were 80 plus to make 1-minute videos about my mother's significance in their life. Now, if you've ever coached 80-plus-year-olds over the phone with technology, you will get a sense of the gift that this was. But here's the gift I got, which is pretty cool. I went up there on December 29th. She didn't know I was coming. My sister met me there. And my sister was not down with getting all those videos made. She said it would never happen, so that's all I needed. And but I shared the credit with her. See how generous I am? I'm only telling you about it. But this is so much about her, I might give this talk to her. She's never heard me. But, so I stuck that little thing with the videos of all those people, and an hour's worth of 1-minute videos is a long 80-year-old's hour, right? And, my mom cried. Happy tears. I've seen my mom cry a lot of self-pity tears, but I had never seen my mother cry happy tears in my life. She said, "I'm so glad I'm 80. I'm so glad it's my birthday. How blessed am I?" Then my dad got cancer. And so during COVID, houses were through the roof, as you know. But I went and bought a house in Cincinnati, 2 miles from my parents. Also, my in-laws, we've been managing round-the-clock care for them remotely for 2 years. My father-in-law was really sick. My mother-in-law, they were old. They were older than my parents. And But I took my sister's husband was dying. My sister's husband lived a long time with multiple myeloma. And so I didn't have a partner in crime to help through that because she had to care for her husband. And so I moved there, and I have a house in Louisville, and I have businesses in Louisville because sobriety gave me this great big life. So I could take my dad to chemo every other week. And then my father-in-law died, and then we moved my mother-in-law in, and she had Alzheimer's. And I'll tell you what, I didn't want to do it. Man, am I glad I did. It's like, it was just the best thing ever. And she, I'm the only one she'd say she loved at the end. That might be why I loved it, but... My girls, by the way, I sponsor transparently and authentically. So my girls, they've all been to my houses. Most of them have met my mother-in-law. They all know because we got her in this flamingo float in my pool, and it was fun, right? And some of them have met my parents, and a lot of them have met my sisters. Jane's been to my sister's house. You know, it's. Because I think it's important in sobriety that I share my real life with you and not the one that I come to these rooms and tell you about. Okay? Like, sometimes my life is messy. Sometimes I'm a little shorter with my mom or my spouse than I want to be. Right? And sometimes my girls have witnessed that. You know, they've also witnessed me make it right. You know, right the ship. I've had to make a lot of sober amends, and I've had to make a lot of sober amends within Alcoholics Anonymous. So I don't care who you are. If you haven't, I encourage you to look deeply. Because if we have relationships with other people, we bump up. If I've been sober almost 4 decades every day in a row, and I've been in AA longer than that, do you think that I haven't hurt anybody? How well do you think I was at 10 years sober? Now, I've been in and out of hospitals since 1998. I've almost lost my life multiple times sober. I got drove over in a highway. They put me on medication. My face was shredded. Guess what happens? Even if I take it right, somebody else handles it, I do all the things right. I'm an idiot. I say things that are not nice. I lose all my thoughts. I have a brain injury. Do you know what a fresh brain injury is like? I don't care, alcoholic or not. A fresh brain injury takes all your filters away. I'll never forget, man, a friend of mine, a social worker, we went to this party, and been done with my rec for like 9 months or something, and we're at this party, and apparently I told somebody what I thought about why her kid wasn't seeing her, and my friend said, now I know what they mean by a brain injury and no filter. So sober, I had to go make those things right. So sober, when I do harm, it's so much more subtle. It's so much more subtle. I have to want to see it. Have I? And I have a big life. I have so many really intimate relationships. I live with somebody. My parents, I'm with them all the time. I have this really close relationship with my sister. I have these sponsees that I'm really intimate with. You know, I have this niece that I'm really like a mom to. I'm like a grandma to. You know, and life gets messy. And the bigger our life gets, and the more people, the more messy. I don't want a smaller life so it's not messy. I don't want less intimacy so it's less messy. I want to get better at not hurting people, which I am, because the hurt is nothing like what the hurt used to be, but it still hurts. If I leave my mom out of a dinner invitation, it hurts her. It hurts her if everybody else knows about it, right? So I got to do something to make my mom feel special. I do. Because I care about her. See, it's no longer black and white, I hurt you, I got to make it right. It's now like, how do I live out loud? How do I live aligned with my Creator? You know? I watched Deb do it with her mom. I watched Jane do it with her mom. See, I know my girls too, right? It's like, So, I've got these women, most of them 20 plus years sober. We're doing this step thingy. I forget how many fifth steps I listened to that summer. What was it, 11 or something? They're a day and a half with me. We don't have 2-hour fifth steps. Because we're going deep. We're older. We have more to see. We have deeper levels to see. And most of the fifth steps lasted a day and a half. That meant that I gave up 11 summer weekends. Not just me. The person I live with. You know? That's why mommy, mother-in-law live with me. Okay? I owe that. You know, I owe that. So I listened to these fifth steps, and I realized that I had to go do mine. So I went and did mine. And I didn't do it with my sponsor who lives in Boca Raton. I did it with a woman in Louisville that I've known for 30 years that knows all of my stuff because my sponsor was traveling extensively, which is often the case. And yes, Snow was my sponsor. And Sue Ells, the person that I did it with, and she didn't pull any punches. I didn't want somebody who was going to pull punches. I wanted somebody that knew me and would tell me the truth. Well, here's the worst thing. She said, she called me up. She says, well, you ready to look at that A-step list? In addition to this, you know, it's like, so this is within the last 2 years. And I didn't want to make an amend that I needed to make to somebody that I loved, that I was avoiding. I just let the relationship kind of change. It just kind of changed. Because I knew that he had been put in a tough position between me and another person. He hooked us up to build a house together, and some things had been tough in that situation. The guy promised 6 months. It took 2.5 years. I was not very happy about it. And Jim had to listen to it from both of us. And I needed to amend my piece in it. And when I did, I said, what else? Is there something else I've done? Because I know that this hurt your feelings. I know that was hard for you. And I'm really sorry I put you in this position. He said, well, I think Steve owes me the $10,000. There was some related to a piece of land. Anyway, he said, but if Steve doesn't think he owes it, he said, I'd like to get that $10,000. Now, that was not what I had in mind for what I was making amends for. Well, guess what? Steve didn't think he owed it. So I wrote the check. Now, I've been visiting with Jim, I don't know, I'll just talk about most recently, the last several months, I'm seeing him often, talking to him a lot. He's my sober dad. I wouldn't have businesses, I wouldn't have anything if it weren't for Jim. He co-signed on a house. He knew I didn't have anybody. We've talked about the stuff. And he said, I just expect you to do it for somebody else. You know, I asked him, why are you doing this? Why are you counting on me? He said, well, if you don't do right, the house is worth more than you'll want it. I'll get the house back. But now, like, he said to me 3 weeks ago, he said, when did you have your most recent spiritual awakening, Sunday?
When did you have your most recent spiritual awakening?
Because he could see something very transformative in me. You know, and I talked to him about how my prayer meditation life went on steroids during COVID. And I talked to him about this group of women. And, I played the flute like 3 hours a day during COVID, native flute. And it changed my meditation practice forever. And because that started it, and then the steps, you know, like everything's connected. But, you know, Don M. used to always talk about the tapestry, and he would say, you know, it's like we just do what the next stitch, and then when it's all done, you get to see the pattern, but we don't get to know the pattern. And that's been the truth with all this and with my immense process. I was on a committee, for a conference. I don't usually do too many conference committees. I'm busy, busy, busy. And there was somebody on this committee that seemed to be bullying people on the committee. And I decided that was my job to stop this madness and put her in her place. Well, it didn't go well. And now I'm ashamed. I'm ashamed because I'm bullying the bully. Right? And so I had to go look at it, and I had to write about it and look at it, and it's like, it's an old idea for me. See, when I was a kid, I stood up. And whenever somebody's being hurt around me, I think it's my job to protect everybody. Well, that's not my job. My job's to love everybody. That's all of our job. God will protect us. We have a God shield. And what hurts us is not always bad. It helps us become better and more. I don't know what hurt you need, so you learn to stand up for yourself. I don't know what that is. It's not my job to keep you from ever being hurt. But I would take that on. So because of that experience, I had to go look at that and be honest and do an old ideas inventory right along with it. Old idea inventory. Boy, that's going deep. I'm going to tell y'all. But So I tried to make amends to this person. And they wouldn't do it. And not only wouldn't they do it, I'm speaking at this conference. I'm the Saturday night speaker. There's 1,000 people there. There's her and her 3 padres in a row. I get up to the podium. Guess what they do? They all stand up and make a big point of everybody knowing that they're walking out of the room. Now, luckily, there are 1,000 people. They weren't that noticeable. Guess what I did? Nothing. I did nothing. I'm still kind. I say hello. Because I can't have a conversation. And I can't change your ability to receive something or work through something. So an amend doesn't mean I'm going to work through it. It means I'm going to be different. It means I'm going to treat her well. And I am not going to talk negatively about her. Even when people are like, oh my God, I can't believe it. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Now, I'm human. My feelings get hurt. I wish they didn't. I don't want that to be true. But I got such a big God and so much love in my life, they don't stay hurt very long, no matter what. And clearly, it still bothers me enough that came up today. Because I want to work through things. I don't know how to not work through things in recovery. I don't know how to not sit nose to nose with you and really lay it out and talk about it and try to resolve it. I don't know how to do that. I I made amends 2 months ago to a girl I used to sponsor in Louisville. Are you getting the theme? See, I didn't make amends 39 years ago and march on, or 30, or 20, or 10. It says continue to grow along spiritual lines. This stuff does not all get taken care of in a 10th step. It'd be beautiful if it did, but it doesn't. I don't always catch myself. I have to go do the deep dive to even see where I hurt somebody sometimes. You know, I don't even know. But anyway, this gal, she's beautiful. I love her. And, I mean, we went through some stuff. You know, her husband relapsed, and he did a white-collar crime, and the FBI came, and I'm there, and we're on our knees, and I'm her God person, I'm her mom, I'm her safe person, her little boy loves me, you know, like, we have that relationship. I've got pictures of her. I had chickens at the time, and her little boy holding my little baby chickens in my living room, and and then we got involved in some business outside of AA. And she's a new realtor, and I'm letting her sell a house for me. Ooh, she's bossy. She wants me to treat her like the expert. I know she's never sold a house. I don't really see her like the expert. So I put on my business face, which she's never seen. All right, which, by the way, doesn't exist so much anymore. And I'm like, I made sure that she knew how experienced I was and how unexperienced she was. Which means that I made her feel small. And it's something that she was probably already afraid in, instead of seeing her, and why is she puffed up and doing all this? And why was I giving her the job anyway? I was giving her a job because I wanted her to make money, and I didn't want to give the money to somebody else, so I either have to trust her or not. I don't give it to her, a micromanager. Right? You know what she did when I made amends to her? She cried. She couldn't imagine that somebody, now she's 15 years sober. She called me the next week to tell me how much it meant. She told me, she basically wants me to sponsor again. But but our relationship is healed. Our relationship is healed. I have hurt sponsees. I've had to go back. See, I used to be like, here's how AA is done. Okay? Most of you know that I have memorized the big book at one time, and I know the Washingtonian history, I know the Oxford Group history, and I proudly shared it with everybody. And my sponsees, when I was 4 years sober, gave me a card. Congratulations on my, what did it say? It said, rules, morals, and values. Because that's what I preached at them all the time. I did the best I could. They stay sober, I stay sober. Lucky us. But I've had to make amends for that kind of rigidity and making people feel less than with their best efforts. You know? And I've had to be willing to continue to look and say, wow, is there a better way? Can I be more open? Can I be more loving? It's funny, when Mari was talking, I don't want the big book changed. And I was so prejudiced against that new little book that's come out. You know, the little thing that comes along with it. Now, I sponsor all these women that are big in service. You know, Jane's big in it. Pam's an alternate delegate. You know, it's like, and so they're all telling me about this book. What's it called again? Plain Language Big Book. And I'm like, well, some people learn to read because they have to learn to read the big book, you know. And I'm giving them every reason, because I'm a crusty old timer, right? And I'm like, I mean, every reason they shouldn't come out with something else that's called Big Book. Our book isn't even called Big Book. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous. And that book's not very big, by the way, if you see it. But and I'll tell you what turned me around on it. First of all, when I have a vision, see, God wrote in a big book, or Bill did, through God, that we realize we only need to know a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation, right? So, if I have a vision for how everything's supposed to be, how is there room for God's vision in anything? Okay? It's all about my vision. It's still about me, what I know, what I think. Harold L., some of you may know him from Missouri. He's taken that book into the prisons. And guess what? It's helping them. And all you got to do is tell me one place it helps somebody, and I'm good with it. Now, if I sponsor you, I'm not using it because it's not how I got sober. I don't know about it. But I don't know that that isn't going to be helpful to somebody. And what I do know is right now it is being helpful to some men in prison. And I've done a lot of prison work. It's one of my favorite places. And so just because it's different than what I've known, I'm supposed to have an open mind and be willing. And if my amends are all about my rigidity, my way, how I see it, what you should do so that it fits in my world to my vision. And my improvement is always, I don't know. My improvement is to live like this. Otherwise, why do I need to go to God in what Cindy's going to talk about tomorrow? Why do I need to go to God in the morning and ask Him what it should look like? I already know. I have every answer. So I'm living my life to make amends for already knowing, for having all the answers. When I have a my way or the highway mentality, I hurt people. And I have hurt people. That's what I mean by these deeper amends. Because it's my way or the highway. You're wrong. I'm right. Do I have any time left or am I done?
1 minute.
1 minute. I'm going to use this 1 minute wisely. The hardest thing for me in long-term recovery was work. I have all this responsibility. I felt like an imposter. I'm CEO of this company. I can't do nothing it does. We do work globally. It's just incredible. I started it with $1,700 to my name. You know, God has just graced me. But what happened with my gift is I became controlling with it and I became afraid. Because I didn't feel like enough. See, needing to be more to be enough has always been my Achilles heel, whether it's in AA or anywhere else. And so at work, you know, and what's happening is I'm becoming reactive at work. See, people, just because you pay them, don't do everything you say. It's crazy. And so I'm being, you know, that ass boss, you know, and I'm just lashing out and I'm putting them in their place and I'm harming people and I'm hating myself. Because I don't like to be reactive, and I don't like to hurt people. And I worked and worked and worked on it. What Deborah talked about in her talk, you know, it's like I can't do it. Only God can do it, right? But I was willing, and it began to change. And I went like a month, and I didn't do that. And I thought, whew, I got this. And I did it. I called Jim. I said, Jim, I'm crying. I did this again. And he says, Cindy, that's how you know you need God. Now, those men that work for me, it's mostly men. I have a tech company. They've never had somebody come and sit down with them and own their behavior, especially a boss. I've got a millennial guy that's worked with me for 20 years. My CTO was with me. He died of ALS last year, but he was with me more than 20 years. You know, I've got all these young people. We were in a meeting with an out-of-town client last week, and there wasn't a person that worked for me at the table that had less than 7 years with me in my company. That's very unusual in these days. It's because bonds are developed through our vulnerabilities, not our strengths. That's what you taught me here. And so when I'm willing to go to you and not from here, but from here, and say, your voice matters. That's my amends to them. Their voice matters. I will hear them. And if they haven't convinced me, we'll still do it my way. But I will hear them. You guys have given me an amazing life. I don't know where I went with this talk today. I know this. I love you very much. I'm so grateful to be sober. Thank you.